Good afternoon, and welcome to the fall series of Philosopher's Cafes. I'm Martin Tweedell, David Gulla, Don Carmichael. Where is Don Carmichael? Way back there. And I have put together this series of cafes that will be meeting every 2 weeks, except at the very end. The last cafe will follow the previous one by just 1 week. And we've got a general theme, as always, for these cafes. I should say the cafes are sponsored by the Ronning Center, Chester Ronning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life. The theme for this one is a question, somewhat satirical question, is everything up for sale? And the series of cafe, or the theme, and really the series of cafes, is inspired by a book which recently was published by the Harvard professor and philosopher Michael Sandel. And this is the book, and there's the title of it there, What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. And I'm going to introduce you to Professor Sandel shortly, but first I want to mention that it would be helpful and I think entertaining for you all if you were to purchase a copy of Professor Sandel's book, of which I have about 20 copies here that on consignment from Audrey's. It costs $17.85. It's quite an easy read and a very entertaining read. I haven't read a philosophy book which made me laugh as much as this book did in a very long time.
Since Aristotle.
Yeah, right, Aristotle, right, especially something like the Metaphysics, right. So if you would like to purchase this book, it's $17.85, and I can sell it to you right up here. I want to talk about the cafes which are coming up. As I said, they'll all be around this title of what money can't buy and what money can buy, and basically what the introduction of markets into society, well, I mean, markets have always been in society, but I mean the increasing prevalence of markets, that is, making more and more things be commodities, that is, things which are up for sale, is doing it to our society. And according to Professor Sandel, it's pushing out what he calls non-market values. But I'll let him speak for himself in a few minutes. In 2 weeks' time, on the, is it the 5th of November? Oh, October, sorry. We're going to have a cafe that will be animated by a professor emeritus of political philosophy at the university, Fred Judson. And the title of that one is Pay Your Dough and Jump the Queue. It's about purchasing privileged access to various things. And that's one topic which is taken up in quite detail in Sandel's book. And then on the 19th of October, we're going to have a cafe entitled You Can't Have All of Me, But I'll Sell You a Part. And that's going to be about the sale and rental of one's own bodily parts. Also a topic which is taken up in Sandel's book. And so we'll go on in that fashion until the beginning of December. So I think this is an interesting topic because, at least in my case, I find myself often torn in quite two different opposing directions. And that's really where philosophical thought begins, right? I mean, if you find yourself having reasons, good reasons, on both sides of a certain question, then you know you've got some thinking to do. And that sort of case comes up again and again in this sort of area where we're exploring the increasing prevalence of markets and of commodification of all sorts of things which didn't used to be commodified at all. All right, so now we're ready to meet Professor Sandel himself, and he will introduce you to one of these topics. David.
Today I'd like to invite you to join me in a discussion of one of the great moral and civic questions of our day. What should be the role of money and markets in our society? Today there are fewer and fewer things that money can't buy. If you should be sentenced to a jail term in Santa Barbara, California, if that ever happens to any of you, you should know that if you don't like the standard accommodations, and if you can afford it, you can buy a prison cell upgrade. It's true. For how much do you suppose? What would you guess? It's about $90 a night. Or suppose you're going to Washington, D.C. You want to sit in on a congressional hearing, but you don't want to stand in the long line that sometimes forms for the free public seats. You can now go to a line-standing company, engage them, and they will hire for you a homeless person or someone else who will stand on the line, maybe overnight if it's a popular hearing, so that you can take your place just before the hearing begins. You can do that also to hear oral arguments before the Supreme Court. Hire a line stander. Or suppose you want to contribute to alleviating a tragic social problem in this country. Every year, thousands of babies born to drug-addicted mothers. There is a charity you could contribute to that uses a cash incentive to try to solve this problem. The charity offers any drug-addicted woman $300 to undergo sterilization. The use of a market incentive to try to solve a social problem. Or suppose you're a pharmaceutical company and you have a new drug that you want to bring to the attention of consumers. By now it's commonplace that you can market directly to consumers with ads on television. You've seen them, I'm sure. If you watch sporting events or the nightly news on television, you could be forgiven for thinking that the greatest health crisis in the world today is not malaria or river blindness or sleeping sickness, but a rampant epidemic of erectile dysfunction. Marketing drugs directly to consumers. Or if you want to fight a war, but you don't have enough soldiers, you can hire private military companies to do the job. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there were more paid military contractors on the ground than there were U.S. military troops. Over the past three decades, we have drifted, almost without realizing, from having a market economy to becoming a market society. The difference is this. A market economy is a tool, a valuable and effective tool, for organizing productive activity. Market economies have brought prosperity and affluence to countries around the world. But a market society is different. It's a place where almost everything is up for sale. It's a way of life where market thinking and market values reach in to spheres of life previously governed by other values, non-market values. Take education. And here's where I'd like to begin our discussion. There are many school districts around the country that are struggling with the challenge of improving the academic achievement of kids from poor backgrounds. A number of experiments are being done in major school districts, urban school districts primarily, to try to lift up academic achievement through the use of cash incentives, pay for grades. This has been tried in New York, in Washington, D.C., and here in Chicago. A few years ago, there was a pilot program with 20 Chicago schools that offered kids payment for good grades, $50 for an A, $35 for a B. In Dallas, they have another version. They pay second graders $2 for each book they read. I'd like to see what you think about this use of cash incentives to try to improve academic achievement. People disagree about it. So let's see what you think. Let's imagine that you...
So I'm pausing it right there because Sandel is about to get his audience's opinions on cash incentives to kids to read books. Now, so before we return to Sandel, can't hear?
The mic is on.
Is it all right now?
It's on.
Well, maybe. Hello? Oh. All right. Sorry. Okay. So, I'd like to ask you, think about that question for a minute, what you think of the practice of paying children, your own children or kids in school, $2 to read a book, all right, and just get your reactions. All right. First, maybe I'll have somebody who thinks that sounds like a pretty good idea. Anybody here want to volunteer to say they think this is a very good idea? Or
yes,
at least pretty good idea. Raise your hand. Right, there she is.
I'll say it's a good idea. And I'll qualify it. We're talking about the states. We're looking at schools that are, from my understanding, quite impoverished. They're struggling. They've had a horrific go of it over the last few years economically. Families have been suffering. So perhaps that might be the only way to stimulate kids to read, to encourage parents to view it as something, get out and do it. Is it the be-all, end-all? Probably not, but at least it's a way to get them going and motivated. Would we do it? Probably not, because in Canada we haven't been facing the same problems they have.
Well, I mean, there are school areas like that in Canada. So are you saying that it's a good idea when you're dealing with impoverished children?
I would say so, yeah.
If you go beyond that to ordinary middle-class kids, it doesn't sound so good to you. Is that your...
That would be right.
Yeah. All right.
I would just like to say that I grew up an ordinary middle-class kid, and my parents paid me to read a book. I can't remember what it was, but we got paid a certain amount for every book we read, and I don't know if it motivated me because I was going to read anyway, but it we followed that practice growing up.
So it was value added in your case.
So what about if we're talking about ordinary middle class family, but you got a kid who, you know, just wants to spend his time on the internet? Do you think it's a good idea there to say, well, look, I think really you ought to learn about books and what you can get from reading them, and I'll pay you a couple dollars for every book you read? Does anybody think that that wouldn't be a very good idea, that that's something wrong with that?
If you're talking about market values, I guess $2 to read Sandel is okay. How about $25 or $50 to read Aristotle?
Yeah, I think... And maybe $100 to read Kant, right? I mean... yeah, right.
That was...
Raymond. There you go.
Under those programs, were they given money to read any book that they chose? I think my...
You know, he doesn't make it clear on that. But, you know, we can suppose that the school, for example, or the parent in question picks out a list of 20 books. And, you know, and books whose difficulty is suited to the age of the student or child in question, and says, look, I'll give you $2 or $5, whatever, for each one of these that you read.
Do you know whether they have done follow-up research that demonstrates or doesn't demonstrate that it works?
I don't think there's any research on that.
I'd like to suggest that there is a different kind of motivation in this, that the motivation doesn't have to do with reading. It has to do with inculcating an attitude towards market and towards money.
Which attitude?
The attitude that everything has its price, and that within the market sphere, everything can be had. So there's an entirely different kind of motivation. So, for example, when I see my children having gone to school in that period, the school was doing all sorts of fundraising things. It occurred to me these fundraising things weren't really what they appeared to be. The real effect of the fundraising event was to teach them about money, to teach them about market, to teach them that in that sphere that everything is business.
Okay.
Well, I'm thinking about the children who perhaps have genuine difficulty with reading, somebody who's dyslexic, who never gets a tap at the $2. It's maybe not his or her fault. And is the money going to the children who don't need the help, and the children who really need the help are losing out?
That issue doesn't come up either. I mean, surely if you did have a class that included dyslexic children, you know, you'd want to make sure that there were other things that kids get rewarded for that dyslexic children could compete in or take advantage of, right? So I think there's going to be a way of handling that as it comes up. Anybody else want to chime in on this one? All right, now we had a little discussion on it. I'm going to take a poll. You'll see that Sandel takes a poll of his audience. So I want to take a poll of this audience. How many feel that basically this is a good idea? Yeah, if you don't push it too far, but basically it's a useful tool to get children to appreciate books and start on a lifelong career of reading books. How many? Raise your hand if you feel that. 1, 2, 3. No more than that? All right. And how many feel that really the dangers in this approach are more than the possible advantages? It's to be avoided. Okay, I see. So this crew is definitely suspicious of this whole idea. All right, David, would you go back to Sandel, please?
The head of the Chicago Public Schools. And to make things simple, let's assume someone comes to you with a proposal to pay young children $2 for every book they read. Let's begin with a poll, a survey of opinion in the room. How many think it's an idea worth trying, and how many would be opposed? Let's see first, how many would be in favor, or at least think it's an idea worth trying? Raise your hands. In favor? Keep your hands up. And how many are opposed? How many would reject the idea out of hand? All right, let's start. The majority in this hall are against. Let's start, and we have runners with microphones so that we can hear from you. Let's start with those of you who would reject this proposal. Why would you object to it? What's wrong with it? Who will get our discussion started? Yes. Stand up, and we'll get you a microphone. Yes, please. And give us, if you would, your first name.
My name is Leslie, and I would worry that we're going to drive the wrong performance because we're using the wrong incentive and the wrong behavior, and they figure out a way to read stupid books or things that wouldn't really get at what we're trying to change. So I think the incentive isn't measuring the right thing.
It's not measuring the right thing, says Leslie. Let's hear from someone. Do you agree or disagree with Leslie? Go ahead. Stand up and tell us your first name.
Hi, my first name is Karen, and I'm an early childhood educator, and I believe in developing passions and love for things, and you cannot buy those things. They're priceless. So those things are developed by good parenting, good values and mores in a society, good teachers and good principals.
Passion, wait, stay there. Passion and the love of learning for its own sake?
Yeah.
And money can't buy that?
No, those things can't be bought. Certain things just can't be bought by money. You can be rich in job and poor in paycheck.
All right.
Being a school teacher develops the love and the passion.
Right. What grade level do you teach?
Early childhood. Well, I'm not teaching right
now. Yeah, early childhood.
I was really 3, 4, and 5 years old. Really early childhood.
Really young kids.
In the beginning.
So you wouldn't pay them money to read books?
No.
No.
Not at any age.
All right, stay there. It's Karen?
Karen Harris.
Okay. Now let's hear from someone on the other side. Someone who, as superintendent of the schools, sees a problem and thinks it might be worth giving it a try. What? Yes, tell us your name.
Hi, Ivan.
Ivan. Ivan, what would you say? Speak directly to Karen and tell her why you think this is a plan worth trying, even in her school.
So, to put it in context, I'm not an educator. I know relatively little about education, but my daughter has started kindergarten recently. The kids get green, red, or yellow based on behavior every week.
Right.
All the kids who are green get to pick out a prize at the end of the week. And the teacher said ever since she's instituted this process, all the kids have been green every week for years. So,
and would you go from green to the other kind of green, cash?
Well, I mean, this is a physical prize. So in their world, in the kindergartner's world, this is currency. It's as valuable as cash.
And so what about when they reach 4th, 5th, 6th grade, 9th grade? Then would you start paying, they don't want little tokens. Will you pay them cash, Ivan?
I think that it all depends on execution. It goes back to your point about, or someone's point about reading dumb books. If they're paying $2 and they can game the system, then I would say no. If there's a clear way to align financial incentives with the overall educational goals, I would absolutely support those financial incentives.
What do you say, Karen?
I think that children should love to go to school. They should be running into their school. It's a place that should make them feel safe and happy and want to participate in the things that are intriguing and interesting around their classroom and the people who are teaching in that classroom.
Right.
So I can't relate to that sort of, but we're talking about perhaps two different types of communities. Do you see what I'm saying?
All right, let's hear from someone else who favors this proposal as a way of motivating the kids. Who else? All right, toward the back. Yes. Stand up. Stand up and tell us your name.
My name is Xavier Smith from Epic Academy, and I do favor this because I love reading books, and why not get paid for reading something that you love?
So, wait. Tell me your name again.
Xavier Smith.
Xavier says, why not the best of both worlds, Karen? He reads books. He's learned to love reading. But Xavier also likes to make some money on the side. Why not? All right, here, let's get it back to Karen.
I think the wrong value is being set about passion.
No, but Xavier has the right value. He loves learning, he says.
Well, but you love learning, but maybe you should get a job too, a part-time job. I don't know.
Well,
I can't relate to those.
Xavier, all right, what do you think?
It's a different sense of value.
I find that if you are reading a lot and then you do read more like rigorous books and you keep doing them, you're getting money, obtaining it, and you keep going, you're gonna love to read even more. So,
all right, who agrees with Xavier and would like to go for the financial incentive? And is there someone who would like to add to that side of the argument? Go ahead. Yes.
Hi, I'm Jana. We have children. We don't allow TV in our home during the week because we love to read. We promote reading. But we also believe in financial incentives. And I was on vacation with my kids and my wife on an overseas trip. And we were having a little difficulty motivating them to read their books.
And how old are the kids?
8 and 10.
8 and 10.
So we said we will pay you $20 for each book that you read.
Wow.
Guess how many books they read on that vacation?
How many?
15 each.
That was an expensive vacation.
Much more expensive than I expected. But I will say I don't expect to pay my kids to read books for the rest of their lives, but it absolutely motivated them in a unique way. They could earn that, and I think it was a good jump start to help them grow in their love of learning. Over time, they won't need that.
All right, it was a jump start to come, and I'm sorry, what's your name again?
John.
John. John says the money was a jump start to get them to love learning. Yes. What do you say? We'll pass the microphone down.
Hi, my name's Zoe. I'm a high school student at Global Citizenship Experience. I have to say something about my belief in the way we raise our children now, and I'm 17, so I'm still being raised, but I think that this kind of, and I'm not saying that I don't love Mr. Rogers, but this idea of everyone's special, and we're raised with this like soccer trophy, everyone gets a trophy for just showing up type mentality. And I don't think that that's fair. I think that you should...
Did you vote for or against the cash incentive?
I'm not sure.
You were in the middle.
I'm in the middle.
But you've heard the arguments now. Have you been swayed?
No.
No? What about John's example where the $20 per book got his kids to read 15 books each?
But that's saying that because you're doing something, you automatically get a reward. And I don't think that's fair. I think that you have to earn what you're doing, and by telling students that if you read a book, if you just do this little thing for me, you're going to get $20, that's saying that, you know, they're going to expect a reward for everything they do, and I don't think that that's the real world.
Uh-huh. Yes. Go ahead. On the side.
Hi, my name is Kashanta Dixon. I'm from an organization called Embark, and I am 17, a Harper High School student. And I think you need passion to start off anything. You need to progress. So if a second grader don't like to read, you can start them off with paying $2. And then next thing you know, they ain't going to need the $2 no more. They're going to want to read anyway. And next thing you know, they probably use the money to buy books.
All right. But suppose, now you have a lot of faith that once they start reading, motivated by the $2, they're going to learn to love it.
Yes.
What if they become addicted to the cash and come to expect to be paid anytime they read a book? Doesn't that worry you?
All you have to do is maybe stop the cash and see what happens then. And if they keep reading, then you have progress.
Then you would have progress. Okay, so maybe that would be the test. I want to... all right, over here. We'll take one more. Go ahead.
My name is Najee. I'm from Epic Academy. So I don't believe paying kids is a good way to start them reading, but because if you start paying them in their mind, they're gonna say, I'm gonna love reading, but in their mind they're gonna say, because I'm gonna get money. So yeah. If you say, do you love reading books, they're gonna say, okay, are you gonna give me the money? And if you don't have the money to give them, so that's gonna become a problem.
Right.
So I don't believe that.
All right, so Najee, you're saying that if you offer kids money to read books, they're going to read books for the love of money, not for the love of reading?
Yes.
And so you disagree with John's philosophy?
Yes, I do.
All right. All right, well, this helps. I know there are other people who...
So I've cut it off at that point. And so you've heard the people there in Chicago expressing their views on this. And now I want to get back to you and see if, after having heard what they had to say, you have a different view, or you would like to disagree with something that they said or agree wholeheartedly with it. Who would like to chime in on that?
Well, I'm one of these against children being paid to read. For one thing, do you know if they've understood what they've read? Do you know whether they skipped through the book?
Could I just interrupt you there? Because what they usually do in the school is there's a little written test that they have to take after they say they have read the book. Okay.
About the vacation, wouldn't it be nice if that father could take the children on a vacation where they can learn something without having to read books?
I found it odd that they were traveling in exotic places and he was having his kids read books. unless they were travel books or something, or books about the places they were visiting. Right.
Whether you could go to a museum or an art gallery and pick up a book there, which the children might read voluntarily, having seen the pictures and so on. what was the other thing? It is ideally children learn to love to read because they are read to and they see the parents reading, obviously. And this rather reminds me of the Girl Guide cookies that makes me want to vomit, you know. Instead of the children being paid to do some work, they're paid to stand in a shopping center and collect money. A similar sort of thing. And I'm always protesting at that. I protest to the mothers. I protest to the Girl Guide people.
Go over that case again. What exactly is it that you're objecting to?
Well, originally, it was a barber job. This was Baden Powell's idea. We used to babysit, we used to clean a house, we used to...
As a girl guide.
Get a bob. Now children sell cookies, which they don't even make.
They make money for the corporation.
Thank you.
Right. Okay. I get it. Right.
That's about it.
Okay. The woman back there who thought it was a good
so it
idea.
Makes it also engenders a kind of passivity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Well, I'm still kind of on the side of paying them. It's not as simplistic as we're making it out to be. And it really is not just about paying someone to read a book. I mean, that's pretty obvious, I think, to all of us. There are so many things, socioeconomic things. There's people from different backgrounds, people who weren't brought up reading. We know, all of us in this room, that we model, we lead by modeling, we read, and we teach our children to read. What if you're working with someone, as I have, who's never learned how to read and write in any language? How can they model that reading? So you get that child into school. They're very poor, usually, when you're dealing with refugees. How can you give them the incentive to learn? So what's wrong with a little bit of cash incentive? Because while we might not like it, it is a start. And like I said, we all know, I think, that this isn't just about reading. Because there's many jobs out there where people are paid to read and impart their knowledge to other people. And that's a good thing.
I think that we're missing the point of why we teach kids to read in the first place. And that is, it's not just for the point of learning to read. It's for what you can get out of reading something. So what we should teach our children is the reason you want to learn to read is because you open yourselves up to ideas, to imaginations that you wouldn't encounter before. That should be the reward. That's the only reward that there is to get. That's the best one that you can give them. And they'll read.
Mm-hmm. Could I make 2 points?
Sure.
Okay. Well, as long
as they're short.
Well,
I'll pay you for the second one.
No, you pay me to keep it short, and I'll keep it short. The 2 points I want to make is, like, I, first of all, have some difficulty with the background of this issue because, like, a little part of me, like, I just don't think money is that big a deal one way or the other. And I particularly think that when preppy little Michael Sandel prances across the stage, trotting out his Andover and Harvard, I make $200K a year, talking about filthy lucre. I mean, good God. That said, when I was a Boy Scout and Cub Scout, it's a nice day now, and I remember this is the day every fall when we sold apples. And the reason we sold apples was to support the movement. And I think that's not a... I mean, you can use money in different ways that are good things. And training kids to think that they have some duties of support to the institutions and organizations of which they're members, that's a good thing. Now, I don't know about paying kids to read, but I'll tell you what I would do. I mean, I think it's worth trying if you tried it in, say, 20 schools in different districts, only in those, you kept it quiet, and you did it for 20 years, and at the end of 20 years, you looked at what the long-term results were, then you'd have something you could talk about. Short of that, I don't know you've got anything to talk about. In the meantime, what I would do, is like I don't see the point of paying kids to read, but I would pay parents to read to their kids. I mean, if you want to get kids reading, or at least the kids who are ever going to read, that's what I would do. I mean, there's a bunch of ways we could use money. That would be one.
Yeah, paying, but that strikes me as clearly counterproductive. Once the child knows that the only reason his parent is reading to him is because he's getting paid money to do it, I mean, you know, the whole thing turns into a farce.
With respect, maybe you got taught by different kinds of teachers than I did. But, like, I didn't. I had some wonderful teachers, but I had a lot of teachers who clearly never read willingly. So the point I'm trying to make about paying the parents is not that that's a good idea, but that if you want to do something about the literacy levels, you can't do it by a single one-off measure, whatever it is. And certainly, starting with getting kids in contact directly with people who do love what they're doing is a better way to go than anything else.
So, like, for example, you could bring into the classroom storytellers. I mean, professional storytellers who make the excitement of reading things clear. Yeah, that certainly is a good idea, right? Hold on, we have...
Right. Can I shout?
No, we got one person ahead of you. Sorry.
I couldn't help but notice that the two or three men who were asked were for pain, and the women were generally against it.
Thank you. Somebody talked about imagination, someone back here. And those families where the parents aren't able to read, I would imagine they have wonderful stories in their families. Not necessarily, but quite possibly, which are told to their children. And perhaps the children would be interested to know you can find more stories in this thing called a book. Okay, that's one thing. And I wanted to clarify, this person who sold apples, which presumably he picked up or gathered, it wasn't just given to him in a box, our Bobber Job money, it was for the association, it certainly wasn't for us. That's how we earned money for the Girl Guide and Browning Association.
Yeah, right. Well, there's one further comment from the woman in the back there.
Just about bringing storytelling into the schools, there's an organization called TALES, and they are all storytellers. They're a wonderful group to go listen to, and they do go into the schools.
Yeah. I thought that's what we had teachers for.
Now, I want to get you to address one specific comment that was made by Karen there in Chicago. And that was that you can't buy the passion for learning. This was taken as some sort of objection. That is, she thought that money was just being ineffective here, because the thing that you wanted to end up with is a passion for reading in the child in question. And that's not something you can buy with money. You think that was an effective argument?
No, I found it interesting that she is not teaching at present, and the whole thing is how to motivate someone into reading. And if she didn't present a way of doing it in a different way, every human being wants to be treated as unique and special. And sometimes we have had teachers that could look at the classroom and pick out where somebody will be motivated by whatever action. And I found she did not present that.
So, I mean, you're thinking that there are some students, not all, but some, who would be motivated in by money into a passion for reading.
I feel it would be a start, provided they are somehow, whether presented with a book or stumble onto one that awakens what their passion is. And this is kind of the whole crux of where I see what is the motivation, how do you get to the passion? Until I hear, of a better way of doing it, I would say $2 is okay.
Yeah, okay, good. And I don't mean to denigrate reading here, but it sounds a little like, suppose I was a drug dealer, right? And I wanted to get somebody addicted to a certain drug. I might at the beginning say, look, I'll pay you $10 to try this drug out, and get them trying it for a few times by paying them that. And then all of a sudden they've got the passion for that drug, right? Is that the way you're sort of feeling that the startup with reading would work? That is, you pay them and then they sort of get hooked on it, but this is a good thing to be hooked on, of course.
I was looking at enhancing the person's potential rather than destroying it completely.
No, I agree. I totally agree. I mean, you're doing something good for the person here rather than saying, but there is a little bit, Some people are really hooked on reading, especially reading certain types of books, mystery novels or science fiction novels or things of that sort. And you could, you know, get them hooked by first, you know, paying them to actually do it and actually read one. And it might work on some people. So similar, is that the way you're thinking here?
I'm thinking that it's one way of trying it. I would actually prefer a more personal way of a teacher that can decipher, hey, this student would really be good in science, or this one seems to be more towards drama. But if you don't have that, and you have a classroom of 150 students and the teacher is just going through the curriculum, they would say, okay, one has to try other means.
Right. Okay. Good. I think the gentleman in the back. Oh, yeah.
Personally, I have tended to be a reader all my life, but I'm certainly glad that I was never. I'm certainly glad that I was never paid money to read. I was most persuaded by two of the girls in the video, who, as I understood them, are saying that by paying the students to read books, you slowly inculcate that attitude that is somewhat prevalent in our society, that you do things because you get paid for them.
Or that things are only of value if you can get some money by...
Yeah. Some material reward.
Right, yeah.
And in a society that, an economic system that is capitalistic, that the forming of that attitude is reinforced. And like, if this is a good idea, the most I could ever concede would be in a very few limited situations, but to universalize it would be drastic. Do a drastic harm to our education system and to the children.
Well, to what limited class of youngsters would you assign it?
Well, the only argument that I amongst those who favor it that I could maybe grant something is that where there's extreme poverty and serious reading problems, but it would have to be really limited and controlled, and even there I have questions about it. And in the long run, and in looking at the whole system, to me it is not a good idea.
All right.
Thank you. I'm fascinated by the turnout today. I'm a retired high school teacher with four university-educated daughters. And it's interesting always to me to know that I can help a human mind or brain, philosophically, to memorize facts and subject my daughters as they are growing up from birth and before birth at conception to certain stimuli and then have them regurgitate it. But I can never teach a student, of which I'm one at 73, to think. I submit to you what you already know, that when Karen says passion or love of learning, I'm safe, I'm happy. I come here because I'm safe. And what makes me happy from conception is a spiritual spark that each one of you knows what I'm talking about. And that's where the passion, the love, the English word that you want to use, the one, the holy O-N-E, in any language, in any spirituality, that's where it comes from. So, this world economy, the reason I'm here, is wrong. I have been attempted to be assimilated into a world economy that is very, very, speaking of justice and the topics that have gone on before, values, where I suggest the values come from this spark as well. Are you going to pay me to, after I breathe a bit of oxygen and drink a bit of water and have a safe sleep like my cat, are you going to pay me to take the next step and say, I'm going to attend the timing in my personal journey at Philosopher's Cafe and talk about at 10 o'clock on Sunday at City Hall the exchange that is occurring for people who need some clothing and some food and an eye exam. Apparently, this is happening on Sunday on the bus. An indigenous young woman told me with one glass eye. So where does this come from? This part, the values that we have of love. Thank you.
Well, yeah, but do you think that just arises sort of spontaneously and there's really nothing that we can do to encourage it or develop it? Or do you think that there is something that can be done to encourage it?
Of course, when we are conceived, there is something that's being done right away.
No, come on. I want to talk about children.
Oh, okay, but then of course, you're born. You have a certain womb with certain stimuli. Right away, you start to learn, and then you're born, and you take your first inhale and breath, and everything that happens from moment to moment, the gift of a heartbeat, the gift of breath, and the gift of choice from that moment on is determining you in a certain direction, absolutely. But you're not going to buy me or anybody else to go in a certain direction. No. The passion, the love of this type of gathering and exchange cannot be bought. No way. This moment is a sacred moment in a sacred earth that is alive like our closest sun star.
Okay, right. Don wanted to get in, and then I think Nick wanted to make a comment.
I would just like to go back to the point about, I'm going to not speak to that if it's okay, but go back to the point that was made earlier about teachers who use prizes, or I would say gold stars. It seems to me that the currency of note in the classroom is the teacher's time and attention and love. Now, we already use that currency as an incentivizing agency. I am quite sure that a kid who comes into school who's read a lot of books and says he's read a book gets a teacher's nod, but a new reader gets a real smile from the teacher, and I suspect that makes a big difference. So on that basis, assuming that's right, I'd like to just suggest two things. One is, if you have to use money, it would suggest that this much more important kind of incentivizing agency isn't working, and I'd want to know why that doesn't work.
I see.
But the second, though, is I would like to just use this to challenge the idea that there's something wrong with money. The teacher's love and attention is an external agency. You use that to breed a habit in the part of the kid. So the question I would raise to people is, what's the difference between using money and using the teacher's time as rewards for reading?
Mm-hmm. And the teacher's praise and admiration, right. Mm-hmm. Good question.
Well, a couple of points. I sympathized with the lady in the video who said the world doesn't work this way. There are certain things you should learn to do without reward. And that, too, is a part of education. And if we use money as an incentive, it mustn't be done in isolation, and we mustn't forget that there are things that you should do without reward. And the other thing is, as I think about how you incentivize, I'm not sure I like that word, but I think of reading a book with a flashlight under the covers when you're supposed to be sleeping. Maybe it should be prohibited. I mean, slaves were forbidden to learn to read, and so it was obviously a good thing to do. Well, I don't know quite where that one goes, but I couldn't resist mentioning it.
Okay. I said earlier that I was paid to read when I was younger. I don't know when and how it got turned around, but I ended up paying $70,000 to read at a university.
Right.
Where did you learn the most?
All right. Now, I want to talk for a little bit here about the basic theme of Sandel's book. As I say, I've got copies here that you can purchase. Make some distinctions that I think will be useful for you to have in mind in the future discussions during the fall series of cafes. Sandel's the point he tries to make is that apart from questions of fairness and efficiency, turning some items into commodities, that is, some goods or services into something which is up for sale, can, in some cases, certainly not in all, probably not in most cases, degrade the status of the commodity itself, right? So the first distinction that I want to make, and Sandel would back me up here, is criticisms of putting something up for sale or putting it on a market which attack the efficiency of that procedure. What I mean is, like what we were saying here, some people question whether paying children to engage in reading books would actually have the desired effect, right? And that's a perfectly good criticism if you can make it out, right? There are other types of criticism which come up in the book of markets, which are also familiar to us from economics and, anybody who studies anything about current affairs. Free markets, and as Sandel said at the very beginning of his talk, they have in many places been engines of economic development, lifting people out of poverty and into some form of prosperity. No one is denying that some market activity is certainly essential in any economy. And I'm talking here about free markets, where by a free market I mean that the sellers of whatever is being sold are simply trying to estimate adjust their price on their own according to what estimate they make of what the market will bear, right? Rather than having prices controlled by some central authority, et cetera. Okay. Now, it's well known that when you have large markets for things, if the buyers have unequal purchasing power, as will occur in any society where you get inequalities of wealth, that certain problems arise, right? Because the market will be skewed toward answering the or satisfying the desires of the wealthy as against the desires of the poor, and pretty soon it gets easier for a wealthy person to purchase a yacht than it does for a poor person to purchase food to put on the table. Those are problems which are, you know, are quite familiar. And indeed, free markets have a tendency, if you know, they become pervasive in a society, to promote inequalities of wealth, because certain people will be much better at adapting their behavior to the market than others, and soon wealth will accumulate with them. And the more wealth you have, then the more you are able to manipulate the market for your own purposes, etc. And so the market becomes an unfair thing. So there are these criticisms of efficiency and fairness, which people frequently make, economists make, of unregulated markets. And that's one side of the equation. What's new in Sandel's book, and which I'd never seen put so explicitly, was this idea that selling some things actually degrades them. And immediately, I'll tell a personal story here. I thought about my mother. My mother was a very excellent keyboard player, both piano and organ, and was much sought after to play at weddings and church services, etc. But she refused, right up until the end of the period which she could play at all, ever to sell that service. And I could never quite understand this, because especially after my father died, my mother was in need of money, and she could have earned a fair amount playing for church services and weddings and whatnot. But she never did that, and she always rejected it as something, I don't know, I could never tell what it was she objected to about it, right? The way I thought about it. But after reading Sandel's book, I began to get the feeling. The realization struck me that she had some intuitive grasp of what Sandel was talking about. That is, that there was something degrading about, degrading to her services and her talent to put it on the market. It wasn't valuing it in the right way. It was giving it a lesser status than it deserved. Now, I'm not saying that my mother made the right decision there. It's just that now, having read Sandel's book, I have a better understanding of why she did it. But I still am sort of pretty inclined to think that in her circumstances, she should have offered her services at a price, right? So here's another distinction I want you to make, and that is, that if we do decide that putting a certain service or good on the market degrades its status in some way, that doesn't end the discussion, right? That has a certain weight, you might call it a certain moral gravitas, right? But other things have weight too, right? Like surviving in a tough world. Right? Similarly here, I think because of the case for offering children $2 to read a book was put immediately into the context of impoverished children, right? There was an urgency here, right, to help to push these children along. Otherwise, they faced a pretty bleak future, right? And if providing this financial incentive would do that, even for some of them, right, there was a great gain to be achieved. And that has to be weighed against, if you agree with the other people, and I do agree with the other people, that you're not valuing the reading in the right way when you do that, right? So you have to get used to the idea of considerations on both sides of a question having various weight. How much weight? Very hard to determine. Let me give you some more cases, and I want to get your opinions on them. Sandel brings these up, and they strike home with me because I'm sort of a halfway environmentalist. What about these markets in permissions to pollute? It's become very popular now and is being used in Europe to sell, the government sells to corporations that pollute the atmosphere or pollute whatever, it doesn't matter, permits to do that, right? And then those permits become commodities. A market is established for those permits, so that if my company purchases one of these permits, right, it can sell it to another company which doesn't think that it can possibly come within the guidelines for the what pollution it should be producing. And so it purchases my permit, and I sell it willingly because actually I see that I can cut my pollution so much I don't need it, right? The permit to pollute means that polluting becomes a kind of privilege that you pay for, right? It's no longer something which is just despicable. Okay? If it was just despicable, what we would do is put a heavy fine on it. Right? Rather, it becomes a kind of privilege which, if you've got the means, you can pay for it. Similarly, with offsets, people, including well-known environmentalists like David Suzuki, offset their travel on jet airplanes, which are very heavy polluters of the atmosphere. they offset that by, I don't know, supporting some arrangements in Indonesia to preserve some sort of forest which was about to be logged, right, or something of this sort. Again, the offset becomes a purchasing of a privilege to pollute. Right. It's no longer, or if you think of it entirely that way, and I'm sure David Suzuki doesn't, but if you think of it entirely that way, that is, as this privilege, which is a marketable item, then the idea that spewing out carbon dioxide and other gases which are destroying the atmospheres, are increasing the atmosphere's capacity to hold in heat, is just despicable. You know, something we all ought to be ashamed of. You're no longer relying on shame. You're relying on the financial incentive, right? It's costing David Suzuki something to purchase that offset. It's these companies which pollute and purchase permits to pollute are paying something for that. Okay. Now, I wonder, I'm quite torn on this particular issue, and I want to see in the few minutes before we take a break what you think about that particular issue and whether the market in permits to pollute and these offsets is justified under the circumstances, whether you agree that there's really any argument against it. A lot of economists think there's just no argument against it. Right? And maybe you do too. Okay. So I'm asking you what you think.
In an economy where it's where in order to produce, you can't not do some polluting. Inevitably, there'll be some pollution. At least these marketable permits, they can reduce the pollution.
Yes, let's assume that.
Well, they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the only... I mean, it's better to reduce the pollution by whatever amount you can than to do nothing about it. Although I go along with your main argument, yes, but I just thought you didn't concede that it's not possible to, in our system, not to pollute at all.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sort of ambivalent. Hear me all right? Sort of a bit ambivalent on the whole question of carbon trading and credits and offsets myself. Although, as a longtime environmental activist, I'm pretty concerned about the present changes in our climate, and I think if they were to buy us some time until we can turn around and get away from the carbon economy, carbon-based economy, then if they are actually reducing the amount of carbon inputs into the atmosphere, then I would say they're you're not a perfect solution, but a bit of a stopgap. But yeah, I'm still ambivalent on that, Martin, and I'd like to discuss that with you further, perhaps at one of our meetings. But just a note on the side, I went to related to the Earth Summit in Rio last June, and the big concern that there are two camps there, and there is a new movement called the Green Economy, which is supported by a lot of environmental experts, quote, environmental experts. That was one camp. It's supported as a means of, again, buying time, saving what species we can. So, yeah, it's not a perfect solution, Martin, but I'm glad you raised it. And I'm still ambivalent on it, but you know, I recognize the theoretical point you're raising.
Is there anybody who's not ambivalent about this, that just thinks that the whole idea that you know, or this worry that we're no longer treating pollution as something despicable and shameful, should have weigh at all with us in considering these things? Is there anybody who takes that view?
That what?
That the kind of consideration that Sandel would bring up, that in selling permits to pollute, we are just undercutting the moral feeling that pollution is despicable and shameful. We're no longer relying on the moral force of shame in order to get at this problem, but simply financial incentives. Is there anybody who just thinks, yeah, well, so what? Forget the shame and the despicableness and the moral side of it. Let's just get down to the practical side of getting this pollution under control, right?
So you're a real politic, is it? You're into real politics, then?
That would be real politique, right.
But, you know, you said the shame doesn't work anymore. Neither, a shame doesn't work anymore. Neither does the law, because the corporations own everything. So that's why we're into providing incentives to corporations to do something. Now, isn't that?
Yeah, I mean, the alternative, you see, is fines or just putting a tax on carbon. If you take carbon out of the ground, you pay for it. You pay a special tax on it, and then of course you pass that cost on to whoever buys it, and eventually works down to the consumer. Right? That's one way of approaching it, which doesn't do away with the idea that this whole business is shameful and disgraceful. And, you know, you may be right, Seamus, that our political and social system is such that coming at it that way is just not on. It's not viable. Because of the powers that be in our society. I think some economists would probably agree with you on that. And so then we're faced with a situation in which only these financial incentives, only this market and pollution permits, seems to be one which we can put in place. And in that case, you know, I think that's Richard in the back. I mean, what Richard said, I think, holds. I mean, something has to be done. We're urgent here, and if this is the only thing that can be done, we'd better the hell do it.
Yeah, because when you say tax stuff, I mean, who pays taxes? You know, corporations don't pay taxes, so the same people who will make the law will not be paying the taxes, even though they're doing all the extracting.
Yeah, well,
and
that's...
The other thing is, you know, we live in a capitalist economy, okay? So let's look at... I mean, Sandel, it's very well for him to talk about a responsibility at the individual level. But for example, it would be really wonderful if he addressed the issue of the fact that every corporation is counted as an individual, which has all the rights but no responsibilities in the U.S. The fact that you know, this new law about Citizens United introducing money as freedom of speech, how does that work? So everything's up for sale, you know. So, and if, as the saying goes, as the what became very common during the Occupy movement was the 1% versus the 99%. That's the elephant in the room that doesn't often get addressed. You know, this, like David, I think, pointed out, that here is this 200K professor who's prancing about the room, you know, acting like a journalist, putting one against the other. Well, guess what? You know, maybe he needs to address the issue of, from a structural level, from a class level. But will he? You know, why is class so? Why is class not playing such an important part in analysis in you know, this kind of issue? Because it's critical.
I agree with you, except that I think you're being unfair to Sandel, and I'll have to talk to you about that. Somebody else.
We're talking about whether we like offsetting a negative with a positive. Well, if it works, why not? When you start introducing things like morality, ethics, any of those hard words, and you bring them out in today's society, which I find to be somewhat lacking for moral fiber at the moment, why not? The minute you introduce words of conscience, words that speak to shame, you start losing people nowadays, because that's not what you see on TV anymore. That's not what you get fed, inundated with every single day. What you get is bye, bye, bye. Okay, we're going to make things better by doing this instead. So I don't know whether we win in the end or not, because I think you're just balancing something. At some point in the future, it's going to tip, and perhaps not for the better. So I think if we have to use politics, and we have to take our politicians as we have them now, because we seem to keep getting the same ones, then we better do it that way, because at least, like this gentleman back here said, we might be able to save a bit of time, save and make it so that we can at some point in the future do something constructive about it.
I think you've struck the nail on the head, because exactly what Sandel is getting at, sort of indirectly here, is this transition from a mere market economy to a market society. And you've put your finger on what that means. It means that talking about shamefulness, disgracefulness, like I was just doing, you know, who is this guy? What age did he come out of, right? And that's when those when society has that attitude, you've moved into what Sandel calls a market society. Right. Was there anybody else who wanted to?
I'm struck, Martin, by the parallel this has with a particular medieval practice, and I'm particularly struck by my old friend and good colleague here, Ray, good Lutheran clergyman, because my sense is that Sandel is really making an argument against what in the old order was called indulgences, and that my friend Raymond, a good Lutheran, is arguing for indulgences. These offsets are a kind of modern version of the indulgence. They play a similar kind of role.
Sandel himself makes that point.
What I want to say is, I've said this a couple times in previous philosophers' cafes, I really don't believe that people in mass, like society, change, make the required changes until they're at the precipice. till the situation is so dire. Like, for example, well, I would even, this might be a bit controversial, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but the Catholic Church in some issues is so out of touch, they're not going to change, as I think Pope Francis hinted at the other day, until they have totally lost all relevance. I think that all we can do until we reach a point of a dire point, an emergency, is all we can do is very limited changes. Very limited. And that's why I'm saying that we, until society has the will to change, make the necessary changes, because they have absolutely no alternative or they won't survive, until that point comes, you have to use these limited measures to try to make some advances. That's not a very optimistic view, but there is some optimism in it.
It's pragmatic.
It's pragmatic, but it also has the hope that in when we're at the precipice, we can there is some, the changes have been happened in history.
Okay, I'm just going to make this remark. I think that just about everybody here feels the opposite poles, right? And that's the important point. And Sandel's book is about that. It doesn't decide in any particular case which way you should go, right? And I tend, like Ray, to be sort of pragmatic here when you're in an urgent situation, right? But I feel the pull the other way. And it's acknowledging that, acknowledging that you have to do some weighing up here of considerations which weigh in opposite directions. It's one of the hearts of, you know, ethical decision making. Right. So let's take a break for 15 minutes and come back, and I'll ask you some more questions.